we fall here on the upper left corner, and then you have 5, 6, and 7 at the position of the other intertwiners. And when you add, when two vertices meet, they add together. So for example, J1 and J3 adds into J1 and 3. J1, 3 with J5 give you J1, 3, 5, and so on. Okay. And the limit I'm going to take is I'm going to take S2 to be small, and everything else is going to be large. Okay. So in the extreme case that I take S2 to be 0, this becomes a problem of adding only 6 angular momenta together to get 0, because S2 has disappeared. And the 15J symbol is, so in the invariant subspace that describes the 6J's adding to 0, you can label the states by the intermediate coupling. So for example, you can choose the labeling across the rows. So J1, 2, J3, 4, and then you add 7, 6, and 5 to it, so you get 3, 4, 7, and 3, 4, 6, 7. Those correspond to the intermediate angular momenta here. And that labels a state in the invariant subspace. And you can choose a different labeling across the columns. So you could have J1, 3, 1, 3, 5, and 1, 3, 5, 6. And that labels another state in the invariant subspace. And the 15J symbol is essentially the inner product of that of those two states. So that's the 15J symbol when S2 is equal to 0. It's not a coincidence that the vector diagram for the 15J symbol is a combination of three tetrahedra glued together. The exact formula for the 15J symbol with S2 equals to 0 could be decomposed into a product of three 6J symbols. And the labeling for each of the 6J symbol are the six edges of the three tetrahedra here. So it's really easy to get an asymptotic formula for the 15J symbol when one of the J is 0. You just apply the Ponsano-Reggie formula to the individual 6Js. So here's a Ponsano-Reggie formula. It's here V is the volume of the tetrahedra. And the Ponsano-Reggie phase is a sum of six terms, each of which is a product of the J's and the dihedral angles for the tetrahedra. So you substitute that into the three 6J symbols. You get a product of three volumes on the bottom. You also get a product of three cosine terms. And you can expand that three cosine term into four cosine terms, where the phases get combined together. So the first term, you could add up all the phases. And the second term, the linear combinations of the Ponsano-Reggie phases. Okay. Now, what happens when you take S2 to be non-zero? What gets modified is that there's a spinner that attaches to the states. For example, for the coupling across the row, there's a spinner that attaches to the vector J1 here for one of the state. And for the other state, the spinner attaches to the vector J4. And when you take the inner product for the 15J symbol, you get a rotation matrix out from that product of the two spinners. And so that rotation matrix gives you additional phases. And also gives you a D matrix here. This is the real part of the rotation of the spinner product. Is a D matrix. The D matrix is a component of the rotation matrix about the y-axis. So in this case, it's a new mu component of the rotation matrix e to the minus I theta times sy. So sy is a 2s plus 1 representation, dimensional representation of the rotation matrices. Here mu is j12 minus j1, and nu is j24 minus j4. And theta is the angle between the vector j1 and j4. Okay. The imaginary part of the spinner product gives you a modification to the Poisson Ricci phases. And those terms are proportional to mu times phi1, where phi1 is the angle between the j1, j4 plane and the j1, j5 plane. And you also get another term, it's proportional to nu, and times phi4. Phi4 is the angle between j1, j4 plane and j4, j7 plane. So this is the formula that we're going to derive in this talk. Any questions so far? Yeah. R is the sum of all 15j. It's a phase factor. So I guess for so all the j's are large, so all the areas are large in this case. So you're in a semi-classical regime, but one of the intertwiner is small, so that means the two of the areas has a small dihedral angle between them, so they almost overlap. And so this asymptotic limit is physically relevant to a four simplex with two of the tetrahedra that's almost degenerate. But we're still in the semi-classical limit in this case. So it's not as good as a formula with all 15J large, where you can describe a general four simplex, but it's a partial result that you can use. Okay, so let's review the WKB theory. So take the harmonic oscillator. So you have a quantum Hamiltonian half times x squared plus p squared, where p is, I guess, minus I h bar partial x. It's a differential operator. So what you do is you make a WKB ansatz amplitude times e to the is, where s is a function of x. When you apply the Hamiltonian to your wave function in that form, the p-hat operator acts on s, so it brings down the exponent, and what you get instead of p-hat gets substituted by the quantity partial s partial x. Okay, and you make a new variable p that's equal to that derivative, and you get an algebraic equation for partial s partial x. So here you get a classical Hamiltonian for the harmonic oscillator. So in order to calculate what S is, we need to solve for P, and then you integrate P of X with respect to X to get S from that equation.
Don't you get two derivatives as well acting on the S? P squared should have two derivatives.
That's a higher order term. The second derivative is a higher order term that you ignore. So when you bring down 1s, you still get the e to the is attached to it. And when you apply it again, you get another. Right, but you do get a second derivative term, but that's higher order with h bar square, and you ignore that. In most of the problems that we're interested, we have maybe two branches for the S function. And to go from one branch to the other, you just integrate with respect to p dx. When you cross branches, you need to make sure that it's continuous in the momentum representation. And there's some things that you have to do, like Fourier transform into that momentum representation, continue it, and then transform back to the X representation. And that's what gives you, in addition to the integral PDX, you also get a factor of pi over 2. Okay. And when you add up the two stationary phase contributions, you get a cosine term. And all you have to do is to calculate the integral of PDX around the closed loop, and that gives you the WKV approximation to the problem. And that's what we're going to do for the 15J symbol. Okay, so the overall strategy, we're going to define the Hilbert space, which is going to be a combination of harmonic oscillators. So the WKV theory will apply. And we're going to make a similar ansatz. So we're going to make a WKV ansatz for the wave function. Now, because of the small spinner represents an additional complication, so you have to make an ansatz that your wave function is a product of WKV wave function times a spinner. So it's similar to a Born-Oppenheimer approximation in that sense. Now, the spinner presents a huge problem for us because it has a gauge ambiguity. So you can't really pick the spinner uniquely. And so you have to overcome a problem with gauge invariance. And the solution for that problem is to express a spinner in terms of rotation matrices. So we're going to explain that solution. And once you solve the gauge problem, it's pretty straightforward. You just take the inner product of the two wave functions. So you have the WKV wave function, which we can calculate using a similar tool like the harmonic oscillators. And then you have the inner product of the two spinners. And that produces the modifications that we've seen when we look at the results, so the D matrices and the extra phases. Okay, so the Hilbert space we're going to take is, for the large angular momenta, we're going to take L2 of R2. So that's a Hilbert space for two harmonic oscillators. And there's a Schringer model for angular momenta using two harmonic oscillators.
It just was suggested, I know it's elementary, but what's the justification for treating a large spin like two harmonic oscillators?
It's a need for the WKV technique. We can't really.
Are you going to show why it's a good approximation?
It's a good approximation because it's a good approximation for the harmonic oscillators. So the wave functions essentially eigenfunctions or harmonic oscillators. So we know that it works for the harmonic oscillator.
Right,
it's going to work.
I'm really asking a very elementary question. I mean, you have a Hilbert space for large spin. You have a Hilbert space of 2j plus 1 dimensions.
Yes.
And you're approximating it by an infinite dimension of this space.
Actually, we're going to restrict to a subspace. L2, R2 is a direct sum of all the representation of SU2. J equals to 0 all the way up to infinity. And we're going to pick one particular representation out.
Okay.
So we're still using the same dimensional representation. It's just that we needed L2, R2 to do the WKV approximation.
Okay. Are you using the two-dimensional harmonic oscillator? The energy levels are representations of SU2.
Schringer came up with a model for that, where if you restrict the total quantum number for two harmonic oscillator, you're restricted to one particular representation of SU2. And that's what we're going to do. The Hilbert space for the small angular momenta is just the usual 2s plus 1 representation of SU2. The 15J symbol is an inner product of two states in that Hilbert space. And as we've seen before, the two states are simply different labelings for the invariant states for the total angular momenta. So the two sets of labeling, one is 1, 2, 3, 4, and the other one is 1, 3, 2, 4. Okay, so we're going to define what A state is. On top, those are the operators, and on the bottom, those are the quantum numbers. The operators are defined by Race and Lorentz operators for the individual harmonic oscillators. So here, mu goes from 1 to 2, the two harmonic oscillators for each angular momentum. Here, I is just the total quantum number for the two harmonic oscillator. So we're going to restrict it to an eigenspace of I hat, which restricts you to just the 2j plus 1 representation of SU2 within L2 and R2. And then you have the j operators. Here are the Pauli matrices. And the j operator satisfies the commutation relations for SU2. And so the eigenfunctions, the wave functions are satisfied, they form a representation for SU2. And the J1, 2, 3, 4 are essentially partial sums of the individual angular momenta. Notice that J1, 2 in particular is not a diagonal matrix. SX and SY are not diagonal. So this is actually a non-diagonal matrix of operators. And each of those operators are differential operators because the p-hats are differential operators. So to solve this state exactly would be fairly difficult because you're faced with a system of matrices or differential operators. Okay. So instead of solving this exactly, we're going to make a WKB ansatz and simplify the problem. So the ansatz we're going to make is that the wave function is equal to a product of a WKB wave function times a spinner. Here tau is a spinner, the 2s plus 1 dimensional spinner. When you apply these operators to the wave function, in particular, J12 square produces an equation for the spinner, which is J1 dot s acting on the spinner should give you mu times I1 times the spinner. So essentially, the spinner has to be in the direction of J1. This doesn't fix the spinner uniquely. There's a gauge freedom where you can rotate the spinner about J1, and you can get another solution for tau. And so this solution is parameterized by a gauge potential A1. Okay. But once you fix the spinner, the other differential operators acting on the ansatz, just like in harmonic oscillator, we produce some classical Hamiltonians. And those equations define a level set where you can solve for P of x, and then you integrate with respect to x to find S of x to solve your problem. And so those Hamiltonians are the I's. So the IR, R goes from 1 to 7, that's up 2. And then you have the intermediate angular momentum, the J34, 346, 3467. And then you have the total angular momentum. So there's three operators here. The problem with this is that the gauge potential actually appears in your Hamiltonian. So depending on your choice of the spinner, you're changing the level set and you're changing S of X. This was, but for now, I'm going to tell you that you can pick a gauge in such a way that those two terms actually drop out completely. So those are gone with a particular gauge, just like that. so we'll come back to that later. But for now, we assume that we can ignore those two terms. Okay. Now the level set here is very easy to describe because essentially they could be described by vectors in R3, right? So for each phase point x and p, the Schringer operator, as a classical Hamiltonian, maps that phase point into a vector, into six vectors in R3. And the Hamiltonian constraint is essentially telling you that the total of the six j's has to add to zero. And the and for the state A, has to have a particular intermediate angular momenta, you know, partial sums. And the level set is a manifold in C2 to the 6. And at each point in phase space, you also had to pick a spinner on top. So your WKB wave function is essentially represented by a spinner bundle on C to the 12. So let's look at state A. State A is this manifold here, represented by all possible figures like this, where it's parametrized. The manifold is parametrized by the dihedral angles at each of the intermediate angular momenta. So this angle around J3, 4, 3, 4, 7, and 3, 4, 6, 7. You also have the freedom to do an overall rotation. And so for each of the vector configuration, you have a fiber above it in your phase space. Okay. Similarly for B, for a different set of intermediate angular momenta, so J13, 135, and 1356. Okay. And you can move along the manifolds by using the Hamiltonian flows of J3, 4. For example, J34 is going to rotate 3 and 4 about J34. So you can move this point maybe into an intersection, and you get a figure that looks like this with all the correct intermediate angular momentum vector. All the lengths are fixed by the 15J symbol. So essentially, what we're going to do is we're going to do what we did with the harmonic oscillator. We create a loop that goes around the A manifold and back the B manifold. And we calculate the integral of PDX. That would be the argument of the cosine. In addition to the integral of PDX, we also get two spinner products. And so you have to calculate the phase difference between the two spinner products to get those modification terms we've seen when we look at the result. Okay. So essentially, we're going to take the inner product of the two WKB wave functions, take the stationary phase point. When you take the stationary phase point, essentially you're setting the two p's equal to each other, right? Because p is just s prime. And when you set it equal to each other, that represents an intersection in phase space, because p of x is now equal for the two manifolds. And then the spinners are slowly varying, so you can essentially take those out of the integral. And so you get two terms. One term is essentially corresponding to this figure here, and the other intersection is the mirror image of this figure. They're not connected because you can't rotate one to its mirror image. So that's why you have two disconnected intersection points. Okay. Now the phase difference, SA at the second intersection minus SA at the first intersection is the integral of PDX around the loop at the top. And the difference between SBs at the two intersection point is the integral of PDX along the bottom loop. When you add them together, that becomes an integral, a closed loop in phase space. It's the integral of PDX. Now you can do a canonical transformation. So integral of PDX could become an integral of H dt, where H is your Hamiltonian, and T is the conjugate variable in your phase space. And as we've seen, the H's are essentially the J's, the length of the J's. And the T's are the dihedral angles at those edge lengths. So when you calculate integral H dt, what you essentially get is a product of J's times dihedral angles. And that's what's going to give you the Poisson Reggie actions. Okay, so let's go back to the problem with the gauge invariance. So I'm going to tell you which particular gauge would eliminate those two terms, the mu h over I1 and the A1 cross J1. Now the problem with the gauge is that you, for each point in phase space, you have to pick a spinner, so that's a lot of choices you have to make. Well, if instead you pick a spinner at one particular phase point, and then generate a solution at every other point by applying a rotation matrix to that spinner. Remember, the tau A is an eigenspinner of J1 dot S, so the rotation matrix has to follow the vector J1. Whenever you move around in phase space, J1 also moves around. And you have to keep track of that and construct a rotation matrix that follows J1 along. Now, that doesn't uniquely determine what the rotation matrix U is, because you need a plane to uniquely determine the rotation matrix. And so the correct choice is to look at J1 and J5. Those are the vectors that are not moved by the other intermediate angular momentum vectors. So U of A, as you move along in phase space, J1 and J5 also moves around. And U of A is the rotation matrix that maps the configuration J1, J5 from the old point to the new point, to J1, J5 at the new point. And if you pick that gauge, after some pretty long calculation, you show that those two terms are gone. And you're back to the picture where you can calculate the action pretty easily through, you know, rotations. And also you have uniquely picked a spinner bundle for your wave function. So whereas before this spinner is arbitrary for a particular WKB wave function, right now there's a canonical choice that you can take modulo the initial spinner at one point. Similarly for B, so the wave function for the B state is given by a WKB wave function times a spinner, and that spinner is a rotation matrix applied to a particular spinner at a particular phase point. U of B is determined by the direction of J4, obviously, because tau is a solution of J4 dot S. But it's also determined by J7, which is not moved by any of the other intermediate angular momentum. So J13 only moves J1 and J3, similarly for the others. And so U of B is determined by J4 and J7. As you move along in phase space, J4 and J7 moves, and U of B keeps track of them as you move around. Okay, so now we can take the inner products of the two WKB wave functions. Everything we talk about applies so that you still get integral PDX as before, which becomes sums of J dot times dihedral angles. To make the calculation convenient, I've picked tau 1 to be your initial spinner so that you don't have to involve any more additional rotation matrix to it.
Can you show that this scalar product is gauge invariant? Can you show that this scalar product is gauge invariant?
This type of product, yes, you can. Actually, when I did the calculation, I had to perturb the WKB wave function first. You get a perturbation term, and that cancels the extra terms that's coming from the gauge potential. And those two terms exactly cancel out. And so when you change your gauge, you generate additional. So sorry, the two terms, when you change your gauge, there are terms that are generated from the WKB wave function, and there are terms that are generated from the rotation, from the spinners. And those two terms exactly cancel. And that's how you show gauge invariants. Okay. So now we still have to figure out what UA and UB is from one orientation of the figure to the mirror image. For that to happen, you need to construct a loop in your phase space through the various rotation matrices. So let's focus on the right, the tetrahedron on the right of the figure. So that's the figure we originally had. And this is the tetrahedron on the right-hand side. What we're going to do is we're going to reflect across the plane J3, 4, and 7 first, like that. Okay, and then we reflect across J4 and J7 plane, like that. And compare with the initial tetrahedron, notice that J7 doesn't move at all. So all you have to do is you rotate by twice the dihedral angle at J7 back to the original tetrahedron. So that completes a loop for you for this one tetrahedron in the figure. So to achieve those rotations, we need to use the intermediate angular momenta and rotate about twice their dihedral angles. So this is how we do this. First, we use the intermediate angular momenta 3, 4, 3, 4, 7, 3, 4, 6, 7. So first, 3, 4 is going to rotate vector 3 and 4 to the other side of the 3, 4, 7 plane. Okay. 3, 4, 7, twice the dihedral angles, we're going to rotate all three vectors to the other side of the middle, the bottom plane in the middle. And then 3, 4, 6, 7 is going to rotate all four vectors to the other side of the 1, 5 plane. Okay, so essentially everything gets reflected across the bottom plane on the left here. Next, we're going to move the rotated plane in the middle back to its original position. So you apply an overall rotation about 3, 4, 6, 7. So now the original, the rotated middle plane is now back to its original position. In the same fashion, you rotate the reflected, you know, this plane is now reflected across the middle plane, so you have to rotate it back. So you rotate, do an overall rotation about J3, 4, 7. Okay, so that's like two steps. After these two steps, you achieve the first step you want, which is a reflection across the 3, 4, and 7 plane. Everything is now reflected across this bottom plane on the right. Okay. Next, we use the other intermediate angular momenta. So now we're traveling back along the B manifold. So now you reflect 1, 3 across the front plane on the left. You do it again for the middle front plane. And you do it one last time to reflect everything across 4-7 plane. Okay. So that was the second step here. So the first step was to reflect on the, across the bottom plane, and then we reflect across the 4-7 plane here. Okay, so far we've achieved those two steps through a series of rotations about the intermediate angular momentum vectors. The last step, as we've seen, is to rotate about J7 by twice the dihedral angle, about 7. And that brings you back to the original vector configuration. Okay, so we're doing this so that we can figure out what UA and UB is. So first we have to pick two points in the intersection. P, we're just gonna pick, you know, the original vector configuration. And for Q, I'm gonna pick the point after the first set of rotations. So Q represents a figure that is reflected across J1 and J5. I'm picking this choice so that J1, J5 doesn't move at all, so that now UA is essentially just 1. Remember, UA is determined by the vectors J1 and J5. Since it doesn't move, it's just 1. UB is more complicated, but at least you simplify part of the calculation. Okay. So let's calculate the spinner product at the initial point. We have the freedom to choose what the initial configuration looks like. So I'm going to place J1 at the z-axis and J5 in the xz plane. Now from P to Q, so we just calculate what the spinners are. So for tau A, it has an eigenvalue mu. So J1 dot S is J1 times SZ. And the eigenvector, so SZ, is essentially a vector that is non-zero at the mu component. It has eigenvalue mu. So the tau of A is delta alpha mu. Tau of B is a spinner in the direction of J4. So you have to rotate an eigenspinner of SZ about the y-axis, and that gives you the D matrices. And then you rotate about the z-axis to bring the spinner to the direction of J4. And that rotation is by an angle equal to the azimuthal angle of J4. In this case, it's the dihedral angle between the J1, J4 plane and the J1, J5 plane. So you see where those terms are, mu phi 1 comes out here in the spinner product. So when you take this spinner product, you have a term that's equal to a D matrix, and then you have terms that are proportional to mu and nu, and also phi 1. All right. When you move from P to Q, J4 gets reflected across J1, J5 plane. As we said earlier, since J1 and J5 doesn't move, U of A is just 1. U of B reflects J4 across the J1 and J5 plane. It's also determined by J7, which also gets reflected. But in this calculation, we actually don't need to the exact form of U of B to get the final asymptotic limit. All right, so U of A is 1 applied to the spinner at the first intersection, gives you the spinner at the other intersection. It's the same spinner. U of B at tau, it has a similar form. You have the D matrix, which rotates the spinner down to the level of J4. And then you rotate in the opposite direction by angle phi 1 about the z axis. So there's a sign difference between this and this, because phi 1. Taking phi 1 to be positive. And then you have an additional phase that's coming from the Euler angle that's necessary to rotate J7 into place. And we're not gonna need to, we're not gonna be able to calculate that, and we don't need it. So I'm just gonna call it gamma. When you take the inner product, you get exactly the same product, except that the sign between phi 1 is negative. So the phase difference between those two spinner product is minus 2 mu phi 1. And then you also have terms that are proportional to nu. But for all we care is we just need to calculate the phase difference between the two spinner products. So when you add the two terms together and compare the phases, the argument of the cosine gets an additional contribution, minus mu times phi 1, in addition to the integral of pdx. The other terms are proportional to mu. Okay. To calculate what those terms are, you need to pick a different initial point, p and q. You keep the same loop, but you pick different initial points. And then you calculate the spinner products at those different points. P is going to be picked at this step. And then Q is at the end of this step, this rotation. So essentially, it's going to be a reflection across the J4 and J7 plane. And you can do an analogous argument as before. And you get a term that's proportional to nu times phi 4, where phi 4 is the dihedral angle between J4 and J7 and J4 and J1. And that gives you the final asymptotic formula for the 15J symbol. So any questions at this point? And how we arrive at the answer? Okay, so we need to check whether the formula works. So we plug in some numbers. So here, the small angular momentum is about 2.5, and the other one's about a magnitude of 100. Plotting this against J7. The errors are about the same across. Here you put it in the table form, you see that the error is about 6%. But when the exact 15J symbol is small, the percentage error is larger because the errors is about equal magnitude, but when the exact ones are small, the percentage error gets amplified, denominator smaller. But overall, the asymptotic formula works. Okay. Now you can generalize the calculation. Take more spinners to be small. Or if you take 5 and 6 to be small, you get a tetrahedral figure for the 9J, the non-trivial 9J symbol. And the asymptotic formula is in terms of the geometry of that figure, of this figure. Now, in addition to S2 being small, if you take S6 to be small as well, the 3 tetrahedra, the one in the middle gets shrunk into a degenerate triangle. And so you only get 2 tetrahedra out. And that's the figure for the trivial 9J symbol. And the asymptotic formula for that 15J symbol can be expressed in terms of this geometry. And you can take more of them to be small. So 3, you get a tetrahedron out. And for 4, you get a triangle. All right, so in general, the technique applies to general 3NJ symbols, and you can take various large and small angular momentum. Potential applications, I think we're going to leave it to the experts. Our group doesn't really know that much about quantum gravity. I guess all I can think is, since this represents some sort of degenerate force simplex, you can check that certain spinform models are in the gravity sector of the BF theory, just to check that they have the correct semi-classical limit for this particular degenerate four simplex. And the way to do this is to, take S to be large as well, but keeping the ratio J over S to be large. And hopefully, there's an asymptotic formula for the D matrix when S is large. It becomes a cosine term, and so you get a phase out that hopefully reproduces the Poinsana wedge phase for a four simplex. Although it might, so this is one application that you can do. This is similar to what John Engel did with the Barrett's asymptotic formula for the 15J when all J's are large. Another application, you can put the 15J symbol into the propagator and calculate correlation or expectation values of the intertwiner for a simple transition from the tetrahedron to four tetrahedrons. All right, so that's it. Questions?
Are there applications of these results to something other than monographing?
I'm sure there are, but I guess in atomic physics they don't use anything above the 9J. So I think for the 9J you might be able to, small and large 9J, you probably can use it for a problem of coupling two electrons together. But for 15J, I don't know any application in atomic physics. But people in the math department were interested in the asymptotic limits of the various 3NJ symbols for Chern-Simons theory and topological quantum field theory. I don't know that much about it.
So can I have a question? Does this WKB method apply also if you have all spins large?
Yes. So Hal Hager from our group has calculated the asymptotic limit for 9J symbol when all J's are large. We also have the calculation, written some paper on the calculation for the 3J and the 6J.
Yeah, okay, but for the 15J, did you?
Well, we kind of stuck with the 12J right now.
Okay.
So we haven't really gotten there. the small and large, it's an easier problem because you can reuse the asymptotic limits of the lower 3NJ symbols. And all you have to do is to find those extra modification terms. You don't have to go through the whole formalism again. You just have to, apply the rules.
Yeah, so the reason for which I'm asking is that here, the reason for which you get the three Poinsana wedge actions is because you have basically three tetrahedra group. But the full 15J symbol should have, be more than three-dimensional. It should be something like,
I think so, yeah.
You should expect some action for I don't know.
So that formula should reproduce this formula. When you take S to be large and J over S to be large, that should be in that regime of the 15J being all large. And I think you get additional terms because you get a cosine term times a cosine term. So not only you get four, you get A terms. The hard thing about the 15J with all large is that you can't really draw it out like this. Because now SJ2 has to add to J1, it also has to add to J4. But those two vectors are disconnected. And so it's impossible to visualize this. And the calculation gets a lot harder. You have to chase minus signs. But we're working on it.
Okay, and in the regime, so now if you look at higher NJ symbols,
yes.
Do you believe that you could apply this kind of WKB methods for an arbitrary large symbol, like, I don't know, 3NJ will be very large, but maybe with some small spins inside?
Yeah, you can. It's the same formalism.
Like practically, so not that in theory you can do it, but like in practice, do you think it would be computable?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the rules are very simple. The formula is exactly the same. You just have a different geometry. And those angles are determined by, you know, different vectors. As long as you keep track that, you know, make sure phi 1 are between J1, J4, and J4 and another vector that doesn't get moved by the other intermediate angular momentum. There's a set of rules that you can apply. But Valentin's done work on this where he gets a general result for arbitrary 3NJ symbols.
Yeah, for arbitrary 3NJ symbols, if you choose appropriately which then is going to be small, then you can have like a very generic formula.
But
the funny result is that it is always expressed in terms of the geometry of different tetrahedra. So the funny thing I'm thinking about is that it's in some cases you should have a four-dimensional interpretation also in addition. And this is unclear because, I mean, it's very natural when you have those angular momenta to see them as vectors, and then when you recouple them and sum them to zero, you have like triangles and etc.
But no, I was thinking that your approach is more relies more on recursion relation, and I was thinking, I was wondering if this WKB can reproduce the same kind of results.
So actually, the approach we had, I mean, it can deal with the arbitrary NJ symbols, but you have to choose which spins are going to be smaller in a very specific way. You cannot take them randomly, and I think in that approach, you can take them like randomly.
Just to know, is it how many spins do you choose to be small for the 3NG? Is it just one or two or how many?
You can
is it dependent on the
end? In the approach we had, I think we could choose like between one and n. So you can choose them, but you have rules. And I think in this WKB approach, you don't have those rules. It's just that where when you try to go beyond it, it gets messy.
Yes.
Yes.
This is one impossible case where this technique doesn't apply, and that's when there are three small j's in a row or a column. There's a quantum 3j symbol that gets involved, and you don't have a triangle anymore to describe the relationship between the 3j's. So it only applies when you don't have a row or a column that are all small. So you have to pick and choose so that they're in different rows and columns.
When you actually do these calculations, are you using computer algebra or are you doing it by hand?
I plot this using Mathematica. This is from
that part. I see. You had the formula already, but I mean,
yes.
Produce the formula.
You still have to calculate those, you have to construct the geometry, and then you have to calculate those angles.
Uh-huh.
I did this in Mathematica.
Your formula, is it by hand that you compute it?
Yes. You have to compute this.
Can you go back to the wiggly curve? Yeah, the red dots are
the exact value, and the blue lines are the WKB approximation.
The blue line is
the formula, the WKB formula.
Yes,
any other questions?
More questions.
So you also have an estimate of the order of magnitude. This 10 to the minus 14 comes from the volumes that you can reconstruct, right?
Yeah. 10 to the minus 14. So we didn't really calculate, you know, this in the WKB formalism, but it's possible. There's a very nice formula in terms of matrices of Poisson brackets that you can use. For this one, I didn't do it because it comes out from the asymptotic formula for the 6J anyway, so I didn't spend time on it. But there's a nice formula for it.
So, but you also chose the large spin to be of order 100, and in the numeric, yeah, here.
If you choose them to be smaller, then the approximation is still good, and the order of magnitude is a bit higher than 10 to the minus 14. It's higher than 10 to the minus 14.
You can
have like 10 to the minus 8. If you take the high spin, the large spins to be, order 20, for example, and the formula still works. I mean, the error is a bit larger, but it's still a nice approximation. Like, when the Bontarelli approximation is very nice, and this is exactly the same.
But you have to take the small spin to be smaller as well.
Okay, more questions? Or let's thank Yang again.